marshaled on both sides. And the key players in this battle would be the Carluke cavalry. Now, the Chinese had imperial forces, complements of Xuanzang, the emperor back in Chang'an. There were actually imperial-level Chinese division there, at least 10,000 strong, including excellent crossbowmen. But they had also recruited large numbers of Turkish cavalry. Some would put it at 20,000. Ziad, on the other side, Ziad ibn Salah, he fielded tribal Arabic regiments and Persian infantry. And they, too, may have been on the order of 10 or 15,000. But at least half, if not the majority, of his army were also Turkish allies, mostly Carluks, who were fighting on both sides. The two armies came into contact somewhere on the Talas River, and the precise location of the battlefield is unknown. There's some speculation. What is clear is the armies maneuvered for several days, maybe as much as four or five days, before they actually came into contact with each other. And what decided the battle was the desertion of the Carluks on the Chinese side, who went over to the Muslim side. This will happen in other battles later on in this course, where Turks make common cause with each other. What the reasons were for this defection, we don't know. What we do know is for the first 5 days, Ziad was very, very reluctant to commit his Arab and Persian forces in an assault across the river at Chinese infantry supported with crossbows. They may not have had much contact with the Chinese, but they quickly understood the power of what Chinese infantry can do in a fortified position. Once those Chinese lost their supporting flanks of cavalry, then Ziad could launch the attack against the Chinese infantry in the center, and his Turkish allies in overwhelming numbers would eventually encircle and reduce the Chinese army in a great battle of encirclement. And this is apparently what happened. However, the fighting was ferocious. The Arabic cavalry ran right into tough professional Chinese infantry. The Chinese general, Zhao Gongji, rallied his forces and held the center. His subordinate officers fought an excellent holding action, and 2,000 of the Chinese managed to break out of the encirclement and escape, including most of the senior officers who wrote memoirs after the battle. Many of the Chinese soldiers fought on until they surrendered on terms. The Arab sources speak of taking many, many captives. There's a later fanciful story that these captives introduced block printing into the Islamic world. Well, what were the results of this great battle, the first great battle ever to be fought between Muslims and Chinese? It's hard to say. Neither emperor pushed the battle. The emperor in China did not want to avenge the defeat. He had more problems with rebellions back at home, especially the An Lushan Rebellion. The new caliph in Damascus, the Abbasid caliph, really was dismayed by the success not only of his governor, but of all these Turkish allies who proved to be decisive in the fighting. And so what happened is both empires accepted the battle as a draw. And the Talas River, in effect, represents the boundary between the two empires. However, the battle did decide something. The Chinese emperor eventually had to withdraw his forces to meet rebellions, and Chinese influence in the western regions lapsed, and it would not return until the Ming Empress. In the meanwhile, the Islamic Empire did not gain any real estate in this. In fact, the Carluke Turks ended up being the big beneficiaries. They now dominated the central steppes. They were big players in the Tarim Basin. But what the battle did establish was that Islam was a religion of victory, for it had been a Muslim victory. And it was it established the frontiers of the caliphate. And the Turks were now left undisturbed, controlling those steppes. And there they would construct new states, new confederations. They would embrace Islam, and they would soon invade the Muslim world.
Lecture 21, Muslim Merchants and Mystics in Central Asia.
In the last lecture, we ended with the climactic battle of the Talas River, in which essentially Islamic and Chinese armies fought themselves to a strategic draw, even though the Muslims had clearly won the battle. And the result of that battle was essentially to halt expansion by the Abbasid Caliphate. Starting with the first caliph, As-Saffah, particularly his son and successor Al-Mansur, who built the city of Baghdad starting early in his reign, and by 762, the court is in Baghdad, the Abbasid caliphs were content to consolidate rather than to conquer. And that fact underscores a very important point that is at odds with usual popular perceptions in the West. That is, Islam was always a religion of conquest, of jihad, religious war, that vast numbers of people in the early Islamic period, in the early Middle Ages, were converted by the sword. That is, either you accept Islam or you'll be slain. Now, some such acts were committed in the conquest of Transoxiana, especially in the early 8th century, and there are several governors in Merv who carried out such conversions. But really, that is not how to characterize the Abbasid state after 750. In fact, Islamic political and military expansion stops for the next 300 years. And instead, the achievements of Islam are creating a cultural synthesis, a whole new civilization across the former Near East, the Persian Empire, and parts of the former Roman world. And it's this Islamic synthesis that proves so important for the peoples of the Eurasian steppes. Now, there are several reasons why this came about under the Abbasid caliphs. As I mentioned earlier, the Abbasid caliphs shifted the locus of their power to Baghdad. The construction of Baghdad was important because it becomes the intellectual and economic center of the Islamic world, drawing in talent, merchants, and all sorts of people into this great center. And Baghdad will prove the model for the lesser provincial cities of the Islamic world to model themselves in terms of letters, in terms of architecture, aesthetics, and visual arts. And Baghdad, while it is today in Iraq, is really part of the Persian world and is the Muslim successor to the ancient cities of Ctesiphon and Seleucia ad Tigran. The Abbasid caliphs, therefore, centered in Baghdad, promoted cultural activities that produced the brilliant court culture that owed a great debt to Persian civilization. The success of Abbasid civilization rested not only in the caliphs, but in unusual successors of early viziers. Viziers would be the chief ministers. And these were men who came from what is often known as the Barmakid family. They're descended from a fellow named Barmak, who apparently was an early convert to Islam. It was his descendant, Khalid ibn Barmak, who served as vizier under the first caliph of the Abbasid caliph, caliphate, As-Saffah. He was a staunch supporter of the new regime, and what was more important, he apparently knew Sogdian or Tokharian, whatever the language was that was being spoken in the city of Balkh, and his ancestors had administered a very important Buddhist sanctuary outside of Balkh. They had for centuries been engaged in supporting monks, in carrying out theological debates, patronizing the copying of Buddhist texts. And Khalid's family, for really up until 803, when the family fell from favor in the reign of Harun al-Rashid, they turned out to be great patrons of all types of scholars operating at Baghdad. Now, these were not just Arab writers. In fact, far from it. Most of the people operating in Baghdad, creating this Islamic civilization, were not Arabic. They came from different backgrounds. In the case of Khalid and his family, they were already familiar with Buddhism. At least some members of the family retained ties with those members of the family who had not converted. And it's only in the 8th and 9th century where Arab writers actually become familiar with the stories of the Buddha and some of the teachings of the Buddha, because previously rude tribal armies, tribal warriors sacking cities would have just seen what they called idols, that is, images of the Buddha, and they were simply there to be melted down. In addition, various types of writers in both Aramaic and Persian and in Greek were encouraged. These included Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians. They came and began the process of translating the earlier literary traditions into Arabic. This saw great strides in certain realms of endeavor. One was in medicine. The Aristotelian texts, texts of Hindu medicine, that is, texts that had come through Prakrit, the or Tokharian or Sogdian languages, ultimately Hindu in origin, these texts became available. There was a great deal of activity, and we know that the physician Abu Musa Jahbir was a court physician. He was actually introduced to the court by the Barkad Emir, and he began a very important translation of medical texts into Arabic. There was a great deal of mathematical work that was initiated, even though the great achievements would not come until later in the 9th and 10th centuries, which would see the birth of algebra, the invention of algebra. And that was because Greek mathematics and Indian mathematics were now available, a proper notation system was evolved, and translations in Arabic provided Muslim scholars with the information to make strides in mathematics. And therefore, the court at Baghdad really became a brilliant center for the synthesis of earlier intellectual and literary traditions into a new, wider world of belles lettres. In the process, the Arabic language itself was enriched and transformed, both in its poetry, in its ability to express intellectual and mathematical ideas. Numerous loan words were taken from both Greek and Persian, and the language was refined to be more than just the revealed language of the prophet, the revealed word of God through the prophet. It was now a literary language in its own right by 800 AD. There was an important political change that accelerated the process. I mentioned that Harun al-Rashid, who was seen as the greatest of the Abbasid caliphs, he died in 809 after a very, very glorious reign. But within several years of his death, in 811, a civil war broke out between his two sons. Al-Ma'mun was supported by the Eastern Army, particularly the army in Khorasan. The elder brother, Al-Amin, controlled Baghdad. And the war ended in 813 with the victory, effectively, of the Persian party. Caliph Ma'mun was very, very inclined to look to Iran, to look to Persia for his cultural background. His mother was of Persian origin. Furthermore, he took over the role once performed by the viziers of sponsoring different poets and intellectuals, and that became a major activity of Abbasid caliphs the whole 9th into the 10th century. They took a keen interest, many of them, in the intellectual life of their city, which marked Baghdad really as the great capital of the Islamic world. In addition, he undertook two other important measures. One was to turn to a Persian statecraft, to model the court increasingly after the old Sassanid court. This is where the classic harem emerges, the use of eunuchs to protect the harem, the use of Persian ministers, all of the opulence and ceremony we associate with the great Islamic courts. That is really devised in the 9th century and owes its origin largely to Persian traditions. In addition, this empire was studiously, even painfully Muslim. The administrative posts were staffed by men loyal to the caliph. Many of them were non-Arab, many of them were Persian, and above all, the Arab military regiments are increasingly replaced with Turkish soldiers. They are either mercenaries and allies that are hired right off the steps, or they are slave soldiers, often called by terms such as Mamluk or Ghulam. The Arabic term, we'll be revisiting this issue when we look at the emergence of the Turkish power on the steppes, but large numbers of young men, Turks, were sold into slavery, into the Islamic world, to be recruited into the bodyguard and elite units of the Abbasid Caliph because they would be loyal. They were deracinated. They were pulled up from their background. They were taught essentially Arabic. They were converted to Islam. They had no ties to family. They were outsiders. And they were devoted, excellent warriors. And they will become, it is the need for slave soldiers, which becomes one of the major reasons for the expansion of trade between the Eurasian steppes and the Abbasid Caliphate. Well, in addition to the changes in aesthetics and letters, there were also important changes in architecture. And as I mentioned in the previous lecture, that many of our visions of what the early Islamic urban landscape looked like are really have to be eliminated because you're dealing in a world that was still largely non-Muslim. A consequence from that civil war was increasingly entrusting power to local rulers. These men styled themselves as emirs. One of the big winners of that was the Tariyid family. Tahrir, the man who founded that dynasty, had really won the victory that put al-Ma'mun on the throne. He was rewarded with the control of Khorasan, that is the strategic eastern frontier that guarded the borders of Iran, and also gave him access to the caravan cities of Transoxiana. And these rulers took it upon themselves to sponsor arts and architecture, and they set the model for other emirs. The most important of these emirs were the Samanid emirs. And it is difficult to exaggerate the importance of this family, particularly its greatest representative, Nasser ibn Akbad, who ruled from 864 to 892. The Samanid emirs dominated the cultural world of Iran and Transoxiana through the 9th, 10th, even into the early 11th century. The dynasty finally is overthrown in 1003. Its influence was far greater than its political and military influence. What the Samanid emirs did was create essentially the high Persian culture of Islam, which defines Eastern Islam ever after. To be sure, the Abbasids played an important role. They were sponsoring all the intellectual activity, the translations, the debate over the nature of the Quran, an authoritative text of the Quran. But the Samanid emirs were directly hooked up with trade. They had lots of money. It was coming in from the slave trade and other activities. And this money was poured into monuments. And the monuments are of different types. First and foremost is the mosque. Obvious. But above all, madrasas. Madrasas were religious schools with minarets. And then another monument that is easy to overlook, but in some ways was the most important monument for Islamicizing the landscape, and that is the Turbe or the Teke, roughly translated as the Memorial Mausoleum. Now, such buildings are not really tombs in a Christian sense. In the Muslim tradition, the body is wrapped up in a simple shroud and put in the earth. What the Turbe and Teke is a memorial mausoleum above that simple burial. And the one of Akbad, which survives in Bukhara, is a gem of architecture, a gem of tile construction, an early use of dome construction. And it really, really sets the tone for the architectural development of Eastern Islam through the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries. And it's those basic architectural forms worked out by the Samanid emirs that are then later adopted by the Turkish rulers, by the conqueror Tamerlane. And so it is only in the 8th and 9th centuries that the cities of Transoxiana begin to assume a real Muslim face. Besides the Turbe and Teke, you cannot underestimate the importance of madrasas. Madrasas were important for several reasons. In some ways, they provided the functions of a Buddhist monastery or a Christian monastery, the so-called Buddhist Vihara. Madrasas were theological schools. It's where Sharia, the law of Islam, was studied. But all madrasas usually had attached to it kitchens, hospices, various types of institutions to carry out charitable work. They were founded in the cities and supported by merchants and and other pious Muslims as an act of their piety. And the madrasas, in some ways, came to replace the social and economic role of Buddhist monasteries and Christian monasteries that had long been established in the cities of the Silk Road. Now, this is a gradual process. The Samanid emirs did not simply outlaw Christian and Buddhist monasteries and sanctuaries and say, no, 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 it's got to be Islamic. Instead, they patronized these institutions, which gained increasing visibility in the cities. And as more and more merchants and other prominent members of the upper class converted to Islam, they put their money into building programs. And gradually, over a 200 or 300 year period, the cities of Transoxiana begin to assume the urban landscape that is conjured up in popular images. The Samanid emirs also were very much behind the proposition of Persian as a literary language. And that is a point that is difficult to overstress. In Baghdad, all of the disputation over the Quran, all of the medical and mathematical texts were being written in Arabic. To be sure, they were drawing on Persian, Greek, and Aramaic sources. But the Samanid emirs themselves, descended from Iranian converts, they wanted to use the literary language of Persian. And it is in the 9th and 10th centuries that significant Persian literary works are produced. Perhaps the best one known is the so-called heroic epic, the Shahnameh, which becomes the national epic of Persia. That was composed by a very important poet, Firdowsi. And that epic is not only important because it preserves all these earlier national tales before the Arabic conquest, it also shows that Persian has now been recast into a literary language. It is now written in the Arabic script, not in the old Pahlavi script of the Sassanid period, which is what the Avesta was originally written in. No, they're now using an adaptation of the Arabic script, the Kufic script, actually, to be precise. In addition, the language has been enriched by loanwords, and it is a literary Persian. It is not the dialect spoken in the various cities of Transoxiana. In fact, some scholars would argue that the literary Persian of the great epics that are being produced at the Samanid court would be difficult to be understood by many merchants unless they had obtained the requisite training to read those texts. The Samanids themselves are behind some of the intellectual achievements in, for instance, medicine and mathematics. They are known to support physicians and mathematicians as well. But their real impact was in creating literary Persian and the architectural forms of Eastern Islam. The Turks, when they enter into Transoxiana, they have at best a very, very little understood notion of Islam. They are at best practicing folk Islam. But they see in the Persian Muslim culture of Transoxiana in eastern Iran a model for themselves. And the Turks will follow essentially the path of the Samanid emirs, and they will devise their own distinct architecture, Islamic to be sure, but architecture patronized by Turkish rulers. They will take the Persian route of adapting their language, Turkish, to the Arabic script, recording their ancient traditions and essentially creating a national, or better yet, an ethnic identity that is both Muslim and Turkish. So the Samanids really set a very, very important example for the later Turks who will arrive and take over the political legacy of the Samanids. These Turks will also adapt the cultural legacy. Now, how did Islam get out to the peoples of the steppes? I mentioned that when the Turks do enter, particularly the Seljuk Turks, and they're going to be the subject of the next lecture, they arrive, they are nominally Sunni Muslims. They arrive in the 11th century, they've been exposed to Islam at least a century earlier. Part of it is that the nomads inevitably would have contact and trade with the caravan cities. They would see all these marvelous buildings going up, madrasas, turbay, mosques, and the like. But the interchange is far more significant and far more long-term than just being impressed by the new face of caravan cities. For one, merchants in the Abbasid Empire, especially starting in the 8th century, began to convert to Islam in fairly large numbers. There were a number of practical reasons for doing this. One is that by 700 AD, Arabic was supplanting other languages as a commercial language. Second, by becoming members of the Ummah, and especially for merchants engaged in long-distance trade outside the limits of the Abbasid Caliphate, they were seen as representatives of a very, very powerful ruler. And therefore, they carried with them the implicit protection of Muslim law, the protection of the caliph. And in the course of the 8th century, many mawali, that is, converts, began to embrace Islam and learn Arabic. And of course, they traded among the nomadic peoples of the Eurasian steppes. And so the Turks came into contact with these merchants, again, trading for the traditional goods, but also with an appetite for that slave trade, which is a subject of an upcoming lecture. In addition, with the merchants on these caravans traveled religious figures, ascetics, and teachers. This was inevitable. We discussed this on the earlier Silk Road, that Buddhist monks followed merchants on caravans. The Manichaeans, the Christians all went along the different routes. First and foremost among the Muslims were the Sufi mystics. Now, Sufi mystics are not members of the theological schools that are studying in the madrasas, who are reading the Quran, perfecting Sharif. Far from it. They are popular mystics and inspired figures. They got their name Sufi from Suf, which means a white woolen or linen garment, a very, very simple garment which they wore. And they impressed the Turkish nomads with their mysticism and their contact with the other world. These Sufis, these mystics, would be nominally part of Sunni Islam. They're seen as within the Sunni Islamic tradition, but they don't need the institutional apparatus to operate. They don't need the madrasas. They don't need all of the facilities that urban Islam would need. And therefore, they were ideal to travel along with merchants on the Silk Road to enter into the Eurasian steppes. And when the Turks met these people, they were impressed. For one, Sufi mystics put stress on prayer, but also on dance, on trances, sometimes induced by hashish, song, all sorts of activities which would lead the Sufi mystic to achieve an ecstatic state. Well, to Turks, this looked like shamans. I mean, we have guys like this all the time. These are, to use the modern Turkish term, hoca. They are inspired ones. They are teachers. They have some sort of insight into the other world. And therefore, the Sufi mystics increasingly take the place of former Buddhist and Nestorian monks, or the elect of the monarchies. And in time, the Sufi mystics will convince many of these Turks to start going over to Islam. Very often, these conversions are less than complete. Large numbers of Karluks convert to Islam probably at the end of the 8th, the beginning of the 9th century. These are the descendants of the fellows who fought at the Battle of Talas. Well, when later Muslims, teachers, strict theologians of the religious schools, travel among these guys, they find them hopelessly heterodox. They are carrying out animal sacrifice. The women are still running off and consulting shamans. There are a whole bunch of practices, social practices and religious practices, that are not really strictly Islamic. And it's typical with how the, of how the nomads assimilate these religions, adapt these religions,